Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for October 29th, 2020. We are broadcasting this week from the Missing Persons Bureau here at the Georgia Historical Society. I have always been fascinated by stories of people who simply vanished off the face of the earth, and for this year's Halloween podcast, I thought I would share with you four of my favorite stories of people who went missing in history. We'll talk about one of our founding fathers who vanished. We'll talk about perhaps the most famous maritime missing persons mystery ever. I'll tell you the story of a man who literally was there 1 second and gone the next. And finally, perhaps the most notorious missing person case of the 20th century. But before we get to those, let's begin with a quick look at the ever-popular This Week in History. On October 29th, 1971, 49 years ago, guitarist Duane Allman of the Allman Brothers Band was killed in a motorcycle accident in Macon, Georgia, at the age of 24. Duane Allman was born in 1946 in Nashville, and his family moved to Florida when he was 11. He started playing guitar, and he and his brother Greg formed a band called the Allman Joys. It would be the foundation of a uniquely Southern sound that blended blues, jazz, country, and rock. In 1968, Duane became a popular session guitarist in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, working with Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin, and many others. A year later, he formed the Allman Brothers Band and moved to Macon, home to Capricorn Records. Their second album, entitled At Fillmore East, a live album, was hailed by critics as the best live rock album ever. Duane also played guitar on Eric Clapton's seminal Layla album. His unique style of lead and bottleneck slide guitar influenced a generation of musicians. Duane Allman is buried in Rose Hill Cemetery in Macon. On October 30th, 1938, 82 years ago, on the night before Halloween, Orson Welles' radio dramatization of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds was broadcast, causing great alarm across the nation as some listeners feared a genuine invasion from Mars. Wells was 23 the night of the broadcast, and the notoriety made him nationally famous, and Hollywood took notice. 3 years later, in 1941, he would make the motion picture Citizen Kane, in which he wrote, directed, produced, and acted, and it became one of the most influential films ever made. Orson Welles died October 10, 1985, at the age of 70. His ashes are buried in an old well covered by flowers on the Antonio Ordóñez estate grounds in Andalusia, Spain. On October 31st, 1860, 160 years ago, Juliet Gordon was born in Savannah. At age 26, she would marry William Lowe, and though the marriage wouldn't last, as Juliet Gordon Lowe, she would go on to found the Girl Scouts of the USA in 1912. She died on January 27, 1927, at the age of 66, and is buried in Laurel Grove Cemetery in Savannah. The Juliet Gordon Lowe papers are housed at the Georgia Historical Society. On November 1, 1815, 205 years ago, Crawford Long was born in Danielsville, Georgia. British chemist Sir Humphrey Davy first proposed using anesthetic gases during surgery in 1798, but Dr. Crawford Long was the first to do it, removing a tumor from a patient's neck using sulfuric ether in 1842 in Jefferson, Georgia. He used ether in several more surgeries, but didn't publish his findings until 1849, leaving many of his colleagues skeptical of his claim. His achievement as the first physician to use ether as an anesthetic during surgery was finally officially recognized in 1879. Dr. Crawford Long died June 19, 1878, at the age of 62, and is buried in Oconee Hill Cemetery in Athens. On November 2, 1976, 44 years ago, Jimmy Carter was elected the 39th President of the United States, beating the incumbent Gerald Ford. Carter secured 297 electoral votes to Ford's 240, and he won the popular vote with 50.1% of the vote. On November 3, 1957, 63 years ago, during the Cold War, the Soviets launched Sputnik 2, an artificial satellite carrying a small dog named Laika, the first living creature to be launched into Earth's orbit. It was always understood that Laika would not survive the mission, but her actual fate was misrepresented for decades. When the launch was announced, Laika became an international celebrity. The satellite and its passengers soon acquired the journalistic nickname of Mutnik. Contemporaneous Soviet accounts implied that the dog was kept alive for 6 or 7 days into the mission and then euthanized with poisoned food before her oxygen supply could run out. In 2002, however, a Russian scientist revealed that the previous accounts of her death were false. Laika had actually survived only about 5 to 7 hours after liftoff before dying of overheating and panic. It was belatedly made known that Laika's pulse rate, which had been measured with electrodes, tripled during takeoff and only came down somewhat during weightlessness. In 2008, a small monument with the statue of Laika was unveiled in Moscow. Finally, on November 4th, 1922, 98 years ago, British archaeologist Howard Carter discovered the tomb of the Egyptian pharaoh Tutankhamun, judged to be the best-preserved pharaonic tomb ever found in the Valley of the Kings. Carter found the first sign of what proved to be Tut's tomb on November 22nd, but it was not until 4 days later, on November 26th, that a second sealed doorway was reached, behind which were the treasures. After making a tiny hole in the doorway, Carter, with candle in hand, peered into the tomb. Lord Carnarvon asked, "Can you see anything?" And Carter replied with the famous words, "Yes, wonderful things." For the next 10 years, Carter supervised the removal of its contents, most of which are housed in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. Howard Carter became world famous and died March 2, 1939, at age 64, and is buried in Putney Vale Cemetery and Crematorium in Wimbledon, England. And that's This Week in History. And now to this week's program. People have disappeared under mysterious circumstances from the beginning of recorded history, going all the way back to Romulus, the founder and first king of Rome, who disappeared, so it's said, while reviewing his troops in 700 BC. We know, of course, about famous people like Jimmy Hoffa and Amelia Earhart, and supposedly, if you've been following the news, you've heard that JFK Jr. has been appearing at political rallies even this summer. I'm not going to talk about those people today, however. Today, I thought it would be fun to tell you about four of my favorite incidents of people vanishing into thin air, and we'll go through them chronologically. Let's start with the story of John Lansing, Jr. John Lansing, Jr. was most famous as one of the delegates from New York to the Constitutional Convention of 1787 in Philadelphia. He didn't sign the document in the end because he left the convention in July, because he didn't like the way things were going. He thought the proposed new government would take too much power from the states, and he openly opposed the finished product, though he couldn't stop New York from ratifying it the next year. Lansing went on to a long and distinguished legal career in New York. He was trained as a lawyer, and he became a justice of the New York Supreme Court from 1790 to 1798, and chief justice from 1798 to 1801. He served as chancellor of New York from 1801 to 1814, and from 1817 until his death, Lansing was regent of the University of the State of New York. By 1829, John Lansing and James Madison were the last two surviving delegates to the Constitutional Convention. But on December 12, 1829, at the age of 75, John Lansing Jr. left his New York City hotel room to mail a letter and vanished off the face of the earth. He was never seen again, and no trace of him was ever found. Authorities presumed that he had drowned or was murdered, but his body was never found. His fate was a major mystery in New York, and his standing as a founding father who had attended the Constitutional Convention meant that all of America was fascinated by his disappearance. 50 years later, one of New York's most prominent politicians offered an explanation. In 1882, the memoirs of Thurlow Weed, former Whig and Republican political leader in New York State, was published by Weed's grandson. Weed wrote that Lansing was murdered by several prominent political and social figures who found that he was in the way of their projects. According to Weed, his unnamed source showed him papers to prove it, but he begged Weed not to publish them until all the individuals had died. Weed said that they were all dead by 1870, but he didn't wish to harm their respected family reputations, so he decided not to reveal what he had been told. In the Albany Rural Cemetery in Menands, New York, there is a cenotaph with John Lansing's name on it, and of course the town of Lansing, New York, and Lansing, Michigan, are both named for him, and that is all that remains of John Lansing Jr. Next up is the Mary Celeste. And what, you may ask, is that? The Mary Celeste was an American merchant ship, 282 tons, that set sail from New York for Genoa on November 7, 1872, under the command of Captain Benjamin Briggs, who brought along on the voyage his wife Sarah, their two-year-old daughter Sophia, and a crew of eight. 27 days later, the Mary Celeste was discovered adrift and deserted in the Atlantic Ocean off the Azores Islands on December 4, 1872. She was found in seaworthy condition under partial sail and with her lifeboat missing. The last entry in her log was dated 10 days earlier. Her cargo of denatured alcohol was intact, and the captain's and crew's personal belongings were undisturbed. None of those who had been on board were ever seen or heard from again. The ship was spotted on the afternoon of December 4, 1872 by Captain David Morehouse of the De Gratia. As the vessel drew close, he could see nobody on deck, and he received no supply or reply to his signals, so he sent two men over in a ship's boat to investigate. The pair quickly established that this was the Mary Celeste by the name on her stern. They then climbed aboard and found the ship deserted. The sails were partly set and in a poor condition. Some were missing altogether, and much of the rigging was damaged with ropes hanging loosely over the sides. The ship's single lifeboat was missing. They found the ship's daily log in the mate's cabin, and its final entry was dated 8 a.m. on November 25th, 9 days earlier. It recorded the Mary Celeste position then as off Santa Maria Island in the Azores, nearly 400 nautical miles from the point where it was found. The men found personal items scattered about the captain's cabin, but most of the ship's papers were missing, along with the captain's navigational instruments. Galley equipment was neatly stowed away. There was no food prepared or under preparation, but there were 6 months' provisions in the stores. There were no obvious signs of fire or of violence. The evidence indicated an orderly departure from the ship by means of the missing lifeboat. Now, the Mary Celeste was sailed to Gibraltar, where a salvage court was held, and the authorities could not get past the notion that there was foul play somewhere, that there was nothing natural about an abandoned ship in the Atlantic Ocean. There had been all sorts of theories that the captain of the Mary Celeste murdered all hands on deck, threw them overboard, and then got into the lifeboat with his family, never to be seen or heard from again. That the entire crew got into the lifeboat because of some danger on board ship and then couldn't get back on board. That some kind of natural phenomenon occurred, an iceberg or a sea quake that caused the alcohol on board to release its fumes, which caused the crew to think that an explosion was imminent, and therefore they abandoned ship. They even speculated that perhaps a giant octopus or squid plucked the crew off the deck one by one, although that would never not explain, as someone said, how the captain's navigational equipment was plucked off by a squid. It was missing, too. Needless to say, there were a lot of false myths and stories that got out. Now, the most famous was a short story by an unknown author named Arthur Conan Doyle, who at that time was a 25-year-old ship surgeon, who wrote a story in 1884 called J. Habakkuk Jephson's Statement, which told a fictional story of what happened to the Mary Celeste and her crew. Now, in Doyle's story, one of the crew members, who was a disgruntled former slave, convinced the others to murder the captain and sail the ship to Western Africa, where they all offloaded and then set the ship adrift. And of course, there were many copycats over the years, stories written supposedly by survivors of the Mary Celeste. One of the most convincing to a lot of people was in 1913 in the Strand magazine. This one told the story of a man named Abel Fosdick, who was the Mary Celeste steward. In this version, the crew had gathered on a temporary swimming platform, kind of like a big diving board, if you will, to watch a swimming contest in the ocean, and the platform suddenly collapsed. Everybody was gone. Now, everybody except Fosdick were drowned or eaten by sharks. Other theories included, seriously, an alien abduction, a connection to the lost city of Atlantis, or the Bermuda Triangle. Now, after the Gibraltar hearings, the Mary Celeste continued in service under new owners. In 1885, her captain deliberately wrecked her off the coast of Haiti as part of an attempted insurance fraud. The story of the Mary Celeste has been recounted and dramatized many times in documentaries, novels, plays, and films, and the name of the ship has become a byword for unexplained desertion. The 2007 documentary, The True Story of the Mary Celeste, put aside the myths and argued that the most likely scenario was that the ship was taking on water, the ship's pumps were fouled from previous cargoes of coal, and that with a packed hold, Captain Briggs could not determine exactly how much water was in the hold, how much water he had taken on. Inside of the Azores and land, he abandoned ship, and he and his family and all hands went down at sea. Still, no one knows. The Mary Celeste was not the first ship to be found adrift, nor the last. Believe it or not, in October 1955, just 65 years ago, the motor vehicle Joyita, a 70-ton motor vessel, disappeared in the vast South Pacific while traveling between Samoa and Tokelau with 25 people on board. The vessel was found a month later, deserted and drifting 600 miles from its route. None of those aboard, 25 people, was seen again, and a commission of inquiry failed to establish an explanation. David Wright, the affair's principal historian, has described the case as, quote, a classic marine mystery of Mary Celeste proportions. So what happened to the people on board the Mary Celeste? Brian Hicks wrote in his 2004 book, Ghost Ship, and I quote, "There has never been a clear consensus on any one scenario. It is a mystery that has tormented countless people, including the families of the lost sailors and hundreds of others who have tried in vain to solve the riddle. The ghost ship may be the best example of the old proverb that the sea never gives up its secrets." Next up, the disappearance of David Lang. David Lang, that's L-A-N-G, was a farmer who lived near Gallatin, Tennessee, north of Nashville. On September 23, 1880, David Lang was walking through a field near his home. His wife and two children, ages 8 and 11, were outside, and a local judge and his brother-in-law were in a buggy driving up the lane to the house for a visit. All of them could see David Lang walking across the field toward the house. Frank Edwards, in his 1959 book, Stranger Than Science, told what happened next. Quote, "David Lang had not taken more than half a dozen steps when he disappeared in full view of all those present. Mrs. Lang screamed. The children, too startled to realize what had happened, stood mutely. Instinctively, they all ran toward the spot where Lang had last been seen a few seconds before. Judge August Peck and his companion, the judge's brother-in-law, scrambled out of their buggy and raced across the field. The five of them arrived on the spot of Lang's disappearance almost simultaneously. There was not a tree, not a bush, not a hole to mar the surface, and not a single clue to indicate what had happened to David Lang. The grown-ups searched the field around and around and found nothing. Mrs. Lang became hysterical and had to be led screaming into the house. Meanwhile, neighbors had been alerted by the frantic ringing of a huge bell that stood on the side yard, and they spread the alarm. By nightfall, scores of people were on the scene, many of them with lanterns. They searched every foot of the field in which Lang had last been seen a few hours before. They stamped their feet on the dry, hard sod in hope of detecting some hole into which he might have fallen, but they found nothing. David Lang was gone. He had vanished in full view of his wife, his two children, and the two men in the buggy. One second he was there, walking across the sunlit field. The next instant, he was gone. Eventually, the grass around where Lang had disappeared turned yellow in a 15-foot diameter circle, suggesting that some form of energy had mysteriously transported him away. 7 months later, in 1881, his children were said to be playing near that spot. One called out to their father and was said to have heard his voice faintly calling out for help. And it got fainter and fainter, and eventually the sound of his voice faded away. They never heard his voice again. Unquote. Now, it's a great story, and one that I first read about in a book entitled Strange Stories, Amazing Facts, published by Reader's Digest in the 1970s. The story of Lange's disappearance attracted the attention of researchers during the second half of the 20th century after versions of this story were published by Edwards, as I mentioned, in Stranger Than Science, as well as by Harold Wilkins in his 1958 book, Strange Mysteries of Time and Space. All three of these books that I mentioned claim the story as a true unexplained mystery. Numerous researchers subsequently tried to track down evidence that would confirm the story's authenticity, but nothing has ever been found. No 19th century newspaper accounts of Lange's disappearance have ever been located, nor do census records indicate that such a man ever lived. During the 1970s, researchers who contacted a Tennessee librarian named Herschel Payne unearthed a possible source for this story. Payne said that he had heard some people attribute the tale to a well-known hoaxer who lived in Tennessee during the 1880s named Joseph Mulhattan. Supposedly, Mulhattan invented the tale while participating in a lying contest, and with time, the story became part of local legend. But despite this rumor, there's no evidence that Mulhattan was the source of the tale. The more likely source of this story of David Lange was invented by the mystery novel writer Stuart Palmer. In July 1953, Palmer published the earliest known account of the Lange story in Fate magazine. Palmer's article was almost certainly the source that both Wilkins and Edwards later relied upon. Palmer claimed that the tale had been told to him by Sarah Lange, the daughter of David Lange. But in reality, Palmer probably lifted the idea for the story from a short story by Ambrose Bierce, now himself who mysteriously disappeared in the early 20th century. Bierce wrote a story entitled The Difficulty of Crossing a Field, which he included in a short story collection published in 1893 entitled Can Such Things Be? You can still find it and read it. Bierce's story describes a plantation owner who vanishes into thin air. In his 1953 article, Palmer claimed that Bierce's story was inspired by the Lange incident. However, the opposite is most likely true. The Lange tale, written by Palmer, is almost certainly a reworking of Bierce's story. But I still love the story of the disappearance of David Lange. Finally, I want to end with the granddaddy of all mysterious disappearances from the 20th century, the story of Judge Crater. Joseph Force Crater was a New York State Supreme Court justice born in Easton, Pennsylvania in 1889. On August 6, 1930, the 41-year-old Judge Crater left a restaurant on West 45th Street in Manhattan, walked outside, and literally vanished from the face of the earth, much as John Lansing Jr. had done 101 years earlier. He soon became known as the missingest man in America, and the case became a national sensation. It was never solved, and the phrase, pulling a Crater, entered the national lexicon. Crater and his wife Stella were vacationing at their summer cabin in Belgrade, Maine, that summer. In late July, Crater received a telephone call. The only thing he told his wife about the call was that he had to return to New York, quote, to straighten those fellows out, unquote. The next day, he arrived at his apartment at number 40, Fifth Avenue, but instead of dealing with business, he proceeded onward to Atlantic City, New Jersey, with his mistress, showgirl Sally Lou Ritzy, who used the stage name Ritz. Crater returned to Maine on August 1st and traveled back to New York on August 3rd. Before making this final trip, he promised his wife that he would return by her birthday 6 days later on August 9th. Crater's wife later said that he was in good spirits and behaving normally when he departed for New York. On the morning of Wednesday, August 6th, Crater spent 2 hours going through his files in his chambers, reportedly destroying several documents. He then had his law clerk, a man named Joseph Mara, cash two checks for him that amounted to $5,150, equivalent today to about $78,000. At noon, he and Mara carried two locked briefcases to his apartment, and he let Mara take the rest of the day off. Later that evening, Crater went to a Broadway ticket agency and bought one seat for a comedy called Dancing Partner at the Belasco Theater. He then went to Billy Haas's Chop House at 332 West 45th Street, where he ate dinner with Ritzy and a lawyer friend of his named William Klein. Klein later told investigators that Crater was in a good mood that evening and didn't seem that anything was bothering him. Crater's dinner companions gave different accounts of his departure from the restaurant. Now, Klein initially testified that, quote, the judge got into a taxi cab outside the restaurant about 9:30 p.m. and drove west on 45th Street. And this account was initially confirmed by Ritzy, who said, quote, at the sidewalk, Judge Crater took a taxi cab. They both later changed their story and said that they'd gotten into a taxi outside the restaurant and Crater had walked down the street. Obviously, a very important difference as to what might have happened to him. There was no immediate reaction to his disappearance. When he didn't return to Maine after 10 days, his wife began making phone calls to their friends in New York asking if anyone had seen him. Only when Crater failed to appear for the opening of the courts, didn't show up on August 25th, 19 days later, did his fellow justices become alarmed. They started a private search but failed to find any trace of him. The police were finally notified on September 3rd, 28 days after he'd last been seen, and after that, the missing judge was front page news. Now, detectives discovered that Judge Crater's safety deposit box had been cleaned out and that both suitcases full of money that he and his clerk had taken to his apartment on August 6th were now gone. The investigation was hampered by thousands of reports that came in of people who sighted him all over New York and places beyond. Rumors swirled that the judge was being blackmailed by one of several women he was seeing and that was why he had withdrawn money, that a jealous boyfriend had murdered him or had him murdered. A grand jury examined 95 witnesses in October but couldn't decide if he was murdered, if he had staged his own disappearance because he feared pending corruption charges, or if he had sudden amnesia and no longer knew who he was. His wife, meanwhile, refused to testify before the grand jury. Everyone agreed that if he just tried to slip away, it would have been virtually impossible for him to have assumed a new life somewhere else because of the massive and widespread publicity the case received. His picture literally on the front page of every newspaper in the country for weeks. Then another strange twist. On January 20th, 1931, nearly 6 months after his disappearance, Crater's wife found envelopes containing checks, stocks, bonds, and a note from the judge in a dresser drawer that had been empty when it was searched earlier by police. The discovery led to a number of new but ultimately inconclusive leads. Crater was finally declared legally dead 9 years later in 1939. His wife received $20,000 in life insurance and died in 1969 at age 70. She reportedly toasted him every year on the anniversary of his disappearance. No further trace of Judge Crater was ever found. The case was officially closed in 1979, 49 years after the judge disappeared. But, as is so often the case, the story does not end there. 75 years after Judge Crater's disappearance, in 2005, New York police revealed that new evidence had emerged when a 91-year-old woman who had died earlier that year had left a handwritten note in which she claimed that her husband and several other men, including a New York police officer, had murdered Crater and buried his body near West 8th Street in Coney Island, beneath a section of the Coney Island boardwalk that was now the site of the New York Aquarium. That site, during construction of the aquarium, had been excavated in the 1950s. No skeletal remains had been found, and I don't believe the police have ever looked since 2005. For many years, nightclub comedians routinely got laughs with the line, "Judge Crater, call your office." And as I mentioned before, people were known to, quote, pull a Crater if they disappeared. There were sightings continued to be all over the world of Judge Crater, much as there have been of Elvis, from Hawaii to Havana to Africa. But to this day, no one knows exactly what happened to Judge Joseph Crater when he vanished on August 6th, 1930, over 90 years ago. The hardest working engineer in show business, the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS cardboard tube fighting team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our GHS director of media manipulation and free elections is Patty, may you live so long, Maher. The GHS Playground Director, Staff Archaeologist, and Fearless Food Taster is Elise, are you going to eat that? Butler. Our GHS Coordinator of Classroom Indoctrination is Lisa War Eagle Landers. The GHS Maven of Social Media and Library Science is Sabrina Human Search Engine Saturday. Our GHS Efficiency Expert and Controller of German Names is Karen Bodenschatz-Zollner. The Director of the GHS Russian Literature Division is Christy Maple Crisp, assisted by our writing intern, Warren Pease. Our Off the Eaten Path fact checker is Ella Fino. Our staff short order cook is Bert Toast. Our GHS barber is Les Offenbach. Our Off the Eaten Path Russian vacation specialist is Ivana Vikoff. Our staff summer wardrobe coordinator is Bermuda Schwartz. And our Off the Eaten Path martini mixer is Olive Twist. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone and on Spotify. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Be sure and like Off the Deaton Path on Facebook and Instagram as well. Please also visit deatonpath.georgiahistory.com and check out Dispatches from Off the Deaton Path, my blog, and similarly mysterious and unsolved podcasts like this one. Stay safe, stay strong. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. As always, thank you for listening, and have a happy Halloween.